This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Benjamin Bush is a writer. He has contributed to Harper's and other publications. His memoir, Dust to Dust, was published in 2013. Bush is an actor. He had a regular role in the TV series The Wire during its last three seasons. He is a filmmaker and a Marine veteran who served two tours of duty in Iraq. Benjamin Bush will be at Western Michigan University on Wednesday, Veterans Day, for a talk called Homefront Debriefings, The Lives of Veterans in the 1st Civilian Division. Benjamin Bush, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the question of just coming back home. How hard is it when you have seen everything that you might see in combat to then sort of be back at the grocery store or back perhaps at your child's school or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's probably the one good thing that the Hurt Locker got right was when he's standing in that aisle and he just can't make a decision about which cereal to choose. You know, he's had so many kind of profound decisions to make, and then suddenly the mundane becomes almost overwhelming in its lack of consequence. I think that's the biggest thing that's difficult to adapt to, is that you change to different consequences, different responsibilities. Returning from my first combat tour, I had left my wife at home, my family. And my second tour was much different because I left a baby at home with her. And I think all veterans go through this, whether we're talking about a universe that particularly focuses on the combat veteran. And I think to the exclusion of the largest of the veteran experience, which is non-combat, it's just the simple participation in the military, which most of our service members in uniform are part of. But all of it involves this strange severance from family, whether it's just for training or domestic posting or not. We leave our environment, usually at a very young age, right after high school, for officers right after college. And combat was one of those strange environments where I kind of had to prepare not to return. You talk about some people thinking about home all the time, and everyone adapts to that disappearance from your other life differently. But in my case, on my second tour especially, after I'd been wounded and remained in Ramadi, which was a very cruel world in 2005, as it is now, it's controlled by the Islamic State. And I kind of had to give in to the reality that I wasn't coming back. And then to survive and return, I almost had to create a whole new acceptance of the world that I was in. I kind of planned to leave it already. And that was a very difficult part of returning, was coming back from all that pressure to an absence of pressure like that, the absence of imminent danger, to just streets and people going to work and a baby waking up in the morning. The needs of everyone changed, and my part in them was very rearranged. So I had to kind of keep myself really busy for a good long time, and maybe I still do, to come out of that different place into this one.
How mindful can you be of what your absence does to your family, your wife, and your kids, as opposed to just kind of focusing on getting yourself right? Is there time to think about the family, or is the focus on just you getting through day to day when you get back from a combat mission?
I think it's a great question. And I think we have a myopic fixation on the veteran, as if everyone has trauma, which most don't. And we forget the fact that while they were gone, their families were incapable of, first of all, feeling what those veterans were going through, seeing it in a real visceral sense. And their only hope was for the safety of their loved one. And they couldn't participate in that safety. The parent's job in life is to protect their child. And war takes that child from the parent and does not allow the parent to participate in their safety. And it's incredibly difficult for a parent to go through, for a lover, for a spouse, for children. The sense of dependency is very, very different. And we don't look at the families. We kind of all feel that we have to rally around the veteran upon the return, and we do. But there's equal pressure. There's the wish for survival. There's the worry over this kind of imaginary land that the veteran's living in by the families that we simply don't really acknowledge. We don't support. And we finally rushed to kind of understand the heavy burden of some of these experiences on veterans, but we still have left the families out of this. And I'm hoping that when I'm down in Kalamazoo, we can kind of gather everybody back together and begin to share the family side as well, because, you know, service, though it ends up being a kind of a solitary experience by that veteran, is a very shared event in a family's life.
As someone who did a couple different tours in Iraq, is it tougher to get yourself in the mindset to actually go into combat, or is it tougher to get into the civilian mindset when you get back home?
I found it far more difficult to adapt to civilian sensibilities after I'd essentially discarded them in favor of combat sensibilities. You know, you return home, and especially from Iraq, where we'd had so many explosive devices planted along the roadways, you know, you regard trash in a totally new way, just along a regular street. There's a new suspicion of your environment, and we take our world for granted that it's not going to kill us most of the time. And a lot of veterans don't have that shared belief anymore for a while. It takes some time to kind of allow for just the general landscape not to be a threat. And I think that was hard for me to adapt to, still on a personal level. My suspicions remained pretty high for a long time. But I think that's part of the experience. I think preparing for combat is something that you train for. You know, I went through years and years of preparing for that event, for that kind of trouble. And honestly, I was far less, I guess, psychologically jarred by its actual arrival because of that preparation and because of the singular focus you have. In life, you know, in Kalamazoo, you don't usually have singular focuses. You have a day where you have to accomplish certain errands. And there's an awful lot of time built into that. In combat, you have one thing to worry about. You know, you're searching for an enemy at all times. And your tasks are so specific. I think it's a hard thing for a veteran to adapt to is that real sense of urgency and sense of purpose. And we talk about sense of purpose with veterans having problems adapting. In the military, you have a very clear task all the time. And I think that is a hard thing to lose. I think a lot of veterans have the difficulty, you know, kind of grasping their place in the world when they're released from those responsibilities, especially things which are very particular to their military occupational specialties. You know, it's an interesting question. What's harder? Personally, I thought returning was more difficult, just on an adjustment level. I think you can adjust to greater stresses more easily because your body's wired for it. You know, we're animals in our most primal space. Our bodies are built to kind of react to threat. They're not so much built to then come back down from that, you know, and lose the energy of those moments. So it's a long answer, I guess, but.
You wrote in the foreword to the book, Standing Down from Warrior to Civilian, about how discharge is such an appropriate word for what happens when you leave the military, because the soldier very suddenly goes from combat to civilian life. In some ways, is it almost too abrupt of a change for that person who actually has been in combat?
I think so. And I think the military has also incorporated a better sense of time afterwards. In the reserves, not much at all. I think the reserves, the ones that really had it the worst, because they came directly from a far more civilian life. They were thrown directly into the immersion in military life, and then were thrown right back into civilian life again. Most active duty, you know, they train for war all the time. Then they deploy to it, and then they return to a base which is filled with veterans, filled with similar experience, whereas reservists are thrown right back into the ecosystem. You know, they're thrown back into a dilution of people who have no shared experience, have no shared perspective on what just happened. And I think for them it's very difficult because it's such a profound transition. There is no air built into that. And I kind of describe, I think, you know, talking about coming from deep water, you know, divers have to return to the surface very, very slowly or they will die. You simply can't change pressure that quickly. The physical body can't adapt to it. And the mind can't either. And I think this is something where we go to the mind as much as the body. You're suddenly released from those pressures into, you know, shopping again and mowing lawns and regular life, which despite its stresses on everybody else who doesn't serve in the military, they're very different stresses. I think you're onto something with that strange transition and sometimes it being far too quick. So I think one thing that rescues us, and I'll certainly talk about this when I'm in Kalamazoo, is that the arts create that space where we can begin to interpret our experience. We can begin to find pieces of our experience in the work of others who have been trying to express it. You look at Western Michigan University, where this is going to take place. There are 700 veterans enrolled at that place alone. That's an incredibly large concentration of recent veterans. So I think that's also an interesting opportunity that colleges have created in the GI Bill. A lot of these people who have served to go to a place where thinking is examined, you know, where thought is being explored, where the arts are held as common, whereas they really aren't on Main Street. Art in America is greatly diminished. Our sensibilities for art history, our education, our appreciation has been very distanced in the last half century, damagingly so. And it's still preserved in universities. So I think it's an interesting place for a veteran to kind of go to, instead of just going back into any regular job, to go into a place where their thoughts are valued, where critical thinking and examination are being forced upon them, and where the only way out is conversation. You know, you can't go to college silently. And so I think talking service, which is what this is called, is kind of a part of that buffer.
Have you found that when you've come back, the creative outlets you have, you know, as a writer, as an actor, and maybe not everybody is in quite your universe here. They're not the son of a novelist, and they may not get on an HBO series like The Wire. But is there something to the idea that having a place to perhaps express yourself creatively helps you deal with what you saw in combat and helps you deal with that transition back to being a civilian?
I think the arts help everyone deal with everything. I think we're all either listeners or storytellers. But in the end, we all respond to story. And we all have one. You know, people will talk about, there's so many veterans who are not combat veterans. I mean, 90% of them are not combat veterans, probably a higher percentage. That doesn't make less of anything they've been through. They have changed their environment and their lives. They've moved, been transplanted, been uprooted. For a period of time, don't own your life. You're given orders. They aren't called requests. And so I think storytelling is kind of a primal thing. If I can do this right, you know, what I want is to make a fire we can all gather around, and everyone has their turn. I don't know that any one particular genre satisfies what I'm trying to articulate. I think I've certainly been dealing with my combat experiences, but also just my experience in childhood. The journey of a life is filled with experiences, some of them traumatic without going anywhere. You know, I lost my parents. That's about as bad as it gets. You know, whether it was a heart attack or a bullet, loss has similarities everywhere in everyone's life. And I've found that language has been incredibly important to me. I thought earlier on in my life, I was always an artist. I was always drawing and sculpting. And I thought I could express everything by way of imagery. And my father was a storyteller. Kind of the two of us never really crossed lines until after his death, when what I had left were words. When I was in Iraq, I wrote a letter home once a month, just trying to kind of make sense of my own place in the world, because we didn't have reporters where we were, and Ramadi was too dangerous, nobody even showed up. So nobody knew what was really happening there. And for our part, we barely knew what was happening there. So I was finally forced to only use language, just write that one letter and be as articulate as I could about place and happenings. And it was only there that I realized how powerful words are. I should have known beforehand, obviously, but I really didn't until I personally had to use them. And I'm hoping we can encourage veterans who don't come from, you know, an artistic background to still revert to the thing that we have between each other, which is always conversation, which is always language, it's always stories. If we can inspire, even if they aren't going to write, if we can inspire some people to read things which have been written about their experiences, and maybe in that, find something which speaks to them, find something that makes them no longer alone, then I say we win. So I'm always going to back the arts when it comes to our own health.
Do you think that the idea of talking service kind of speaks to maybe the tradition of wanting to know what has happened in battle, and perhaps, you know, those of us on the civilian side, we're curious as to what's happened there, and sometimes those who have fought are reluctant to share it. But is there something of a tradition that maybe talking service gets at, of that at the end of the day, those stories do need to be told and shared, not just amongst us now, but for generations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are cave paintings. The hunter goes out, and there's a certain dreamscape that we want to leave behind. There's an archive of story. I was just at an arts festival in Waukegan, Illinois, and I had some of my photographs up, and I was just invited to stop in and speak briefly in a veterans facility where, you know, as a care facility for veterans, and most of them were Korean War veterans and Vietnam veterans, a few younger veterans from the recent wars. It was just kind of a gathering. It wasn't any particular, you know, Veterans Day celebration of any kind. It wasn't Memorial Day. And they had one speaker who I'd never heard of, who was going to speak before I came out. And there's this little gentleman who was unassuming in every way, was about half my height, and he was about to be 98 years old, and he'd been a prisoner of war, captured in Africa in the beginning of the Allied offensive, and kept in Germany for most of the rest of the war until the end, where he was liberated by the campaign in Europe. And it was an amazing story. And I asked him afterwards, you know, if he'd written it down, if it had been recorded. And he kind of looked surprised. it had never been recorded. So I went to his house the next day on my way back to Michigan, and I recorded his story for 3 hours with him. These stories exist in so many families, in so many houses. And it wasn't that he was keeping it even a secret. It's that he didn't even think it was that important. It was just part of his life. It was a 3-year piece of a 98-year life. And I think you'll find in the community, Kalamazoo, there's so many veterans from so many times in our nation's history that a lot of these stories, especially non-combat stories, are lost to us. They just disappear one veteran at a time because either we don't ask for them or we don't provide a place for them to be brought forth. So I'm hoping that we can encourage more of that. I don't want to sound academic or kind of conventional in reaching out this general hand, and I hope we hear more stories. But I think there's certain conditions that have to exist for a story to come out. And, with veterans, the VA post, you'll hear them talk because they feel that they're in a company of people who understand what they're saying, almost a different vernacular. There's someone who will understand the humor of some of these experiences. And there's some spectacular comedy in the military. And just, I think if we can take that out of these secluded places and make them more kind of generally accepted and invited, then we'll get these stories again. And we'll start to put them down on paper. And once again, I'm not telling everyone to be a writer, but to value the language of these stories, I think is very important. And we're not talking about creating a generation, many generations of super articulate storytellers. There are fragments of story, which we end up calling short stories, that are beautiful, that are just remarkable in every way. And some people tell them and don't realize how powerful their own words are. And I've heard people tell these stories. I've heard mothers, and this is another thing you were talking about earlier with families. Mothers birthed us. For 9 months they carry us in a sack of seawater, and they give us life. Half your father's genes, half your mother's. That's an incredibly profound relationship. And to then give that child up to an experience which promises danger is incredibly hard. That's an incredibly powerful severance. And many of these young veterans go to it willingly. And what I've found from a lot of mothers, especially those who have read my book, my memoir, Dust to Dust, is they're finally trying to understand their own children. Like, why would you do this? I warned you. Why would you leave and do this on purpose? It's not always economics. It's not always a good recruiting ad. Sometimes there's just a primal urge for some of the things that the military promises. And even though the soldier will be betrayed, that's the thing that the war experience proves every time, no matter how we write it. There's something that drives us towards risk, which I've found very interesting in that the parents are trying to figure it out. And it's language. It's these stories. It's the exposure of the commonplace. Because the veteran very rarely comes back and tells their parents what it was really like, what it was like even on a boring day. Most of all these experiences, most of the space of service is waiting for something. We're just doing kind of idle tasks in preparation for larger events. So, so if we can get to that kind of relationship with our community, where these stories can become, as commonplace as the stories of everything else, as common as sports discussions and the weather. These little pieces of our history, if we can begin to fill that in, I think we'll become a really interesting place again. And this talking service is about kind of showing everyone the value of their own history and, you know, sharing it.
I have to ask you one question about acting. Salon did a story where they interviewed you and talked about your role on The Wire and kind of the interesting connection that you make between that and what you did in Iraq. You said part of what you did in Iraq was acting. How so?
Well, I was incredibly frustrated in Iraq. I mean, it was an unbelievably frustrating conflict on every level, culturally, ideologically, militarily, locationally. I mean, there wasn't much good to plumb from that place and time. But I couldn't express my frustration. I couldn't be frustrated in tribal meetings. I couldn't allow my own sensibilities, which were very American, to insult the sensibilities of a place far more ancient than America. You know, I had no high ground. And so I had to kind of constantly wear different veils. You know, to my Marines, I was confident and invulnerable. To the tribes, I was understanding and conciliatory. To the environment, I had to be essentially unaffected, even though I'm not a big fan of heat. So I'm a Michigan guy. I think there were all these different influences on me, which I had to use my face to lie about. And that's acting. And I think there's so much acting in the military. I mean, you find any staff sergeant or a senior enlisted service member, and they create entire personas, many of them built on the personas before them. But, you know, you watch Full Metal Jacket for one of the great personas ever. But truthfully, they hired that guy because that was the job he had to do. He was brought in as an advisor for the film, and they ended up firing the actor and just hiring him because he had to do that at boot camp all the time. And all of them did. This is an incredible cadre of actors who are being terrifying and horrifying. And I remember when I was just a young candidate, I didn't even have a name anymore. I wasn't a Mr. or anything. I was Candidate Bush because I was in the officer candidate program in between my junior and senior years at Vassar, of all places. And I was down in Quantico being tortured by the Marines, hoping that I would quit. The whole purpose behind the officer candidate program was to get rid of as many of us as they could. And they were very good at it. But I remember we had Liberty, which is an interesting title for all the names in the military, I think, are fascinating. Part of the language, you know. If you have free time, it's Liberty. And I went to a movie in 10 weeks. We had like this one little moment where we could leave base on a weekend for a day. And I went to the theater and I saw my staff sergeant with his family. And he didn't realize that I was in the audience. And he was being sweet and loving. And, you know, we had to kind of bury ourselves in the back row and then hide and leave before the end of the movie so he wouldn't see that we had seen him being human. Because he was one of the most terrifying individuals we had ever met just a day earlier. Because that was his job. That was his performance work, was to be, kind of the devil incarnate. So I think there's a lot of that in the military. And some of the things that are said are maybe the best dialogue ever created by people. So I think it's going to find its way into my work for sure. I have a military film that I want to shoot someday, which is very honest to all of that. Back to your original question, you have to wear a certain a certain guise, even without compromising your personality too much. You still have to have masks for the occasion.
Benjamin Bush, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Benjamin Bush is a writer, filmmaker, actor, and Marine veteran. He will speak about the Talking Service program at Western Michigan University on Wednesday, Veterans Day. You can find links with more details at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.